Mm-hmm. सतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Greetings, welcome to our sixth and final call for this series on the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. This is our last class in this series, so I'm looking forward, really looking forward, to continuing our dive into the sutras in our July class, which starts a little over a month. And I also want to say that I'm going to give you some contemplations, those of you who have decided that you want to take the next class, which I hope is all of you. I'm going to give you a couple of contemplations to sort of make the bridge, because one thing that I think many of you have discovered, and which I certainly have discovered, and you know, it's kind of the basis of my life as a teacher and student of the deep wisdom of the yoga traditions, is that when we're diving into a text in this way with practice and discussion, satsang, lectures, reading, that whole panoply of experience that can rest on the wisdom that's coming through a text, we get very kindled, our practice gets very kindled, our sense of what's important gets quite sharp. And because life is so intense these days and all the time pretty much, we can tend to lose our edge when we stop making study and discussion a part of our day. So I've found that it's incredibly useful to have a practice that is kind of my bottom line practice for a particular period. Sometimes it's a chant I'm doing. Sometimes it's a commitment to a particular type of meditation. And even if, you know, the shit hits the fan and life becomes incredibly fraught, having made the decision to make this practice as a part of my day, in other words, not to go to sleep unless I've done it, I found that it's incredibly helpful in just keeping the thread of awareness through many, many different ups and downs of normal daily experience. So I'm going to offer you, it'll come in the homework assignment, a kind of ongoing practice to continue with in the next weeks. And hopefully some of these practices are ones that you'll be doing through your life. So there's just a couple of general remarks I'd like to make before we dive into the sutras and before we dive into the very beautiful invocations and our opening meditations. So during the Q&A on Sunday, someone asked me what I felt is the message of the pandemic. And I spoke about the fact that it's bringing us face to face with the imminence of death. It's making death real for us. But deeper than that, what I realized, I think I may have said it during the Q&A, but it kind of came to me more deeply in the aftermath, is that even more than that dramatic awareness, what the pandemic is doing, I think, for all of us, whether we have loved ones who are threatened by the illness itself or not, it is the most powerful lesson in impermanence that I have to say I have experienced in my life. The world is so utterly radically different than it was 3 months ago. And of course, we don't know what our societies will be like when it's over. But I would say one thing we can count on is that for those of us who are willing to pay attention, this is a really intense wake-up call. Because when you realize, and I know I don't have to say this to most of you, when you realize that everything you've taken for granted can disappear or has disappeared in some cases, you can either collapse in panic, which of course everyone does at certain moments, but or you can really examine what we have to do, how we can use this situation to wake up. And of course, there are so many different ways we are waking up. First, you know, on a daily level, on a mundane, so to speak, mundane level, we're waking up to the fragility of our systems, our social systems, our personal systems, and the need to rethink everything from the healthcare and childcare systems to the social safety net, even to the way we understand money. And, of course, those of us in the yogic journey are recognizing that we're waking up at a deeper and deeper level to the realization that now is the time to practice. Because if we don't, we are likely to run out of time. Most of us know and love that statement which is attributed to Gandhi, be the change that you want to see in the world. It's perhaps the most elegant formulation of this truth that I know. But the thing is, of course, to be the change is not just about becoming better people, becoming more generous, more open-hearted, wiser, more compassionate. It's about seeing through the veil and learning to act in such a way that, in the way that's only possible when we can see past the illusion of being separate individuals in a world of objects. Ultimately, you know, what we have to recognize is that we live in a matrix, a world that's constructed for us by our senses and by the consensus that we as societies have agreed on. And of course, the sages of different traditions have somewhat different takes on how and why the matrix is what it is. But one thing that they all agree on, at least in the Eastern traditions, is that we're caught in a primal misconception about ourselves and the world, that primal ignorance, avidya, and the other kleshas have us trapped. But the trap has a secret exit, and it also has a built-in alarm bell, which every one of us hears again and again. Sometimes we don't pay attention. Right now, we're having to pay attention. But the wake-up call for most of us is suffering. Suffering of physical illness, the suffering of endings, the fact that nothing lasts, including our own bodies, including our happy states as well as our sad states, that's the good news, the suffering of knowing that we will age, that we'll lose our strength, that we'll eventually die, and the suffering of not being loved enough, of the suffering of recognizing fundamental injustice and inequality, the suffering of being prisoners of our samskaras. And I could go on, you know, not having the strength or the competency to overcome our difficulties or the difficulties of the people we care for. But along with the suffering, and sometimes right in the heart of suffering, is the natural joy that is its equal and opposite face. And over again throughout our life, we experience these moments of joy and love and satisfaction, which sometimes pop up in the middle of the worst situations, which give us glimpses of what's possible, of what life is when we're able to get a peek through the veil. Suffering and joy are the two faces of the human experience. And suffering and joy, as most of the sages recognize, that suffering and joy are beyond pain and pleasure. Pain and pleasure are physically rooted. They're a natural part of life in a body, whether it's a human body or an animal body. But suffering and joy come from the state of our mind. This can be hard to accept, but yoga really starts when we accept it, that suffering and joy come from the state of the mind, the state of the prana, the state of our inner instruments, the state of the filters through which we're looking at the world. So we need to be very clear about the reality and the causes of suffering, but we also need to be very clear that the bliss is ever-present and that it's actually the most natural and real part of us if we can just see beyond the veil. So we'll come back to this in a minute. Let's find our posture. So we're sitting now around the lake, the great lake of consciousness. And as you take your seat in your place facing the lake, in this circle of practitioners, of lovers, which for many of you includes people that you'd like to invite to the lake who are here in their subtle form, and you find yourself in a posture that's firm, that's rooted, where your sits bones and buttocks are surrendering themselves into the seat, so you're actually being upheld by the seat, upheld by the earth. You breathe in so that the base of the posture becomes heavy and sinks more deeply into the seat. And as you exhale, you feel the torso lifting up through the crown. And you bring your attention into the heart, feeling the space behind the breastbone. Maybe putting your right hand over your chest to connect the shakti, the energy within your palm, to the energy within your heart space. And see if you can sense the hearts of all of us, of everyone who is here sitting together around the lake. Now, manifest the candle in your cupped palms. And use your magical power to kindle the wick of the candle, to ignite the flame. And then holding it in your cupped hands, create your intention for this evening. And it may be the intention that you've been practicing with throughout our time together, or it may be a unique one. And imagine that you're breathing your intention into the candle. And here's my intention, the one we consider in every class. May our practice uplift us. May it carry us farther and deeper in our journey of enlightenment. May it give us wisdom, comfort, and peace in the weeks and months ahead. May it enable us to be of help to others. And may all beings benefit from what we're doing here together. And holding the candle in your cupped hands, imagine yourself placing it into the lake. And be aware that all of our candles are floating in the lake, points of light, points of flame, points of awake awareness. And we'll chant the opening invocation, three recitations of Om, our invocation to the inner teacher, who's also the great light of consciousness, Shiva, and our invocation to the primordial goddess, who is the creative power that runs through every single particle of existence and also through whatever does not exist. And then we'll chant the traditional invocation mantras to the sage Patanjali. So you can bring your hands into Anjali Mudra or place them back when your right palm face down over your heart, your left palm on top of it. Three Oms. Om. Shivaya Gurave Sat Chit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase Jangalika Yamane Samsara Hala Hala Moha Shantye Abahu Purushakaram Shankha Chakra Siddharinam Sahasrashira Samshvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. One of the lines I love in this chant is the line about the jungle physician. Jungalikaya Mane, the jungle physician is the invisible healer who comes out of nowhere and cures your disease, which no doctor, no mainstream doctor could cure. And this is what this text is about. It's about curing our delusion, curing the kleshas, curing the disease of worldly existence. So with that awareness, you can bring your attention back to the heart. And allow the breath to flow in through the nostrils with a very precise sense of the caress of the breath, the felt sense of the breath as it touches the nostrils, flows through the nasal passages, flows down to the heart. This is your inhalation flowing down to the heart. And sense at the end of the inhalation, slight pause, which allows you in that fraction of a moment before the exhalation starts to be present to the energy within the heart. And of course the exhalation begins, and we've held the breath for a long time. If you've been following me, the exhalation begins and flows out through the nostrils. Allow the mantra Hum Sa to flow with the breath, Hum flowing in like an offering into the heart. Just allowing that slight pause at the end of the inhalation. Sa flowing out through the nostrils, coming to an end in the space outside the body. And just let your attention flow with the breath. Your awareness nestles more and more deeply into the heart. Consider that your heart is a lotus. And some of you may find it very natural to imagine an actual lotus flower in your heart, open. Its petals are open. And in the center of the lotus, there is this thumb-sized flame which not only represents but is an actual subtle visual form of the light of the self, the light of the soul, the jivatma residing in the heart. So the inhalation is like a breeze of prana that kindles your sense of the flame in the heart. And the exhalation allows the flame, the light of the flame, to flow through the whole chest area. And begin to make you aware of your own illumination. So you're invited to open your eyes, but it's not required. This class, this time together, is going to be really quite meditation focused, and in it we're going to examine the last 10 sutras in Book 1 of the Yoga Sutra, which are focused on samadhi, on the different phases and stages of meditative absorption. It's going to be, you know, for many of you, a strong transmission and also a strong inward pull. So I want to tell you that if you just find that your eyes are closing and you're kind of zoning out, just to recognize that that is the rising of the meditative energy, as many of you know, that it's okay, and that it is going to be really important, really, for everybody to listen to this class at least one more time, because a lot of the teachings in it are pretty subtle. And I know in my own experience, when I tune into these teachings, I often have to come back again and again and again to a particular sentence or a particular idea. And as I do, I realize that the idea or the teaching or the sutra is setting off experience in me that I wouldn't have been able to be fully aware of if I hadn't been willing to listen again, read again. And, you know, also to realize that these words, these teachings, are in themselves offerings into the meditative space that we share, and are really designed not only to give information, but to kindle that experience of meditation. So, as Buddha famously and brilliantly said, there is suffering, and there is a path out of suffering. And the path out of suffering is yoga, which exists to give you the ability to become so fully absorbed within yourself that you are able, at least for the time you're sitting in meditation, and hopefully, as these sutras will tell us, more and more during your waking time, so that you're able to actually ooze out of the matrix. You know, the experience of flowing out of the matrix can be quite abrupt, but generally speaking, it is a kind of I use the word ooze because it's kind of a subtle unfolding and a sort of movement into the field of love and creativity and wisdom that actually is the source of this whole thing, this whole manifestation, this full catastrophe. And this is only possible because love and creativity and wisdom are ever present. They are already there. They're not some state that you acquire, but they are the underpinning, the underlying presence, the Shivaness, truly speaking, that underlies even our pain. You know, one of the ways I love to translate the word Shiva, which has several different translations. The more common one is ultimate goodness or ultimate auspiciousness, but it also means that which lies beneath everything, which underlies everything. And that is the love and creativity and wisdom that underlie our whole experience. So the more you give yourself to the yogic process, partly through effort, it definitely takes some effort, maybe more than some effort, maybe a lot of effort at different times, but it's also a natural unfolding that begins when we resolve to look underneath the surface of the mind. And that unfolding goes on. Once we've really committed ourselves to enter the path of yoga, it goes on. It goes on when we're asleep. It goes on during the encounters of our life. You know this. There's so many of you who've been doing these practices for many years, and you know how the unfolding happens sometimes really in ways that you can't even understand until later. But as you give yourself to this unfolding, part of what it shows you is that joy is present even in the obstacles that present themselves in the journey. And, you know, in fact, joy, wisdom, and awareness, even enlightenment, if we want to use that word, are there within the kleshas. So the kleshas, obviously, they're problematic. They're not called afflictions for no reason. I mean, they are extremely afflictive, and they're the template through which all of our painful samskaras, even the painful samskaras that may originally seem pleasurable, they're all based on the kleshas. So the path of yoga is essentially about eliminating the kleshas. But the thing is, this is a non-dual universe, and each one of the kleshas, aside from being, you know, a big shitstorm, essentially, is also a path, sort of the ultimate case of the problem being the solution. So take the core affliction, the source of all the others, avidya, the ignorance that veils reality, that creates the feeling of separation, that deludes us about what this world is really about. So avidya creates huge, blinding confusion about what's real and what's not. But as you start to confront your own cluelessness, what begins to happen, and this is very much the gift of avidya, what begins to happen is that you begin to ask questions, real questions, great, powerful, transformative questions. For instance, what's the purpose of all this? You know, someone said to me a few weeks ago, I wonder if the Earth is not a punishment planet where we're all, you know, we're all stuck because we did something wrong. And this is a very Western religious idea. The Eastern traditions would say, no, it's the arena within which we've been given in order to experience. In order to experience not just for the sake of learning lessons, but also for the sake of actually enjoying the drama of life on Earth. So that question, what's the purpose of all this, if you really begin to ask that question and allow answers to surface from within you, a lot of insight and a lot of impetus for your journey starts to arise. Or another great question, what am I supposed to do with my life? What's the purpose of my life? What really matters? What is actually going to make me happy? What do I need to be happy? What don't I need? And ultimately, who am I really? What besides my moods and my thoughts and my body, my opinions, my social status, my gifts, my skills, my competencies, what besides all this, because all these things, as we begin to realize the longer we're alive in this world, all these things come and go. But in the midst of all this, what is really me? So avidya, ignorance, cluelessness, by throwing this veil of darkness over our understanding of reality, it makes it necessary to ask the questions that will ultimately lead us to freedom. So asmita, the feeling of being a particular separate self, as we're going to see later on, actually, it is the sense of self, the sense of being an I, actually is an object of meditation and a very powerful one. So you can meditate on the felt sense of existing as a me. And as you do, what you gradually discover is that, as many of you know, the feeling of I can be disentangled from the stuff it identifies with, the thoughts and feelings and physical sensations, etc., 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 that we think is me. And you start to realize that if you follow the thread of I am, of I exist, it actually opens up past your limited ideas of who you are and reveals this spacious feeling of knowingness and being. And again, it becomes a path you can follow into the realms of Purusha, the realms of pure consciousness. And of course, attachment, the clinging to pleasure, the that can transform itself from attachment to objects that seem to give us satisfaction, to attachment to your inner resting place, to the inner love, the inner feeling that begins to open the heart as you keep coming back again and again and moving past the blocks and, you know, the energetic walls that are often there in the heart and which will and do begin to dissolve as we let ourselves be more and more present there. And aversion. Actually, one more thing about attachment, because attachment is so connected to desire, which in the classical dualistic yoga traditions is seen as an obstacle, but in Tantra is understood to be the basis of any creativity, from the fundamental creativity of the Shakti to our own creativity. And what we understand when we begin to meditate on raga, on the feeling of attachment, is that behind it can be found profound longing, the longing for peace, the longing for truth. And aversion, which, you know, creates so much pain and burning in its untransformed state, can become a goad, like the goad that the goddess carries. You know, if you've seen the pictures of the goddess Lalita, you see that she carries a goad, like an elephant goad. And that aversion is the goad that turns you away from fake satisfactions of fulfilling externally focused desires and actually gives you the power to let go of the stuff that doesn't serve you, to drop those negative feelings, to, you know, give up your addictions. And abhinavesha, the fear of death and loss, can remind you that the time for practice is right now. You don't have time to screw around. So in this universe, which is here for our liberation and for our enjoyment, this is what the texts of Tantra tell us again and again. It's all here for us. It's all here for us. So yoga shows us that there's nothing here that's not useful in our process of liberation. And as Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, even a little of this wisdom saves you from great fear. Understanding the kleshas and doing the work that many of you have been doing this week of really looking at the way these kleshas show up in your life, in your inner field. As you do this, you start to find your own personal unique key to unlock the door of your personal psychic cage. And 9 times out of 10, it shows up in exactly the place where you're most conscious of your limitations. The Yoga Sutra, like the Bhagavad Gita, is what's sometimes called a post-revelation text, meaning that it comes out of the experience of self-realized sages who have had the revelation of truth arise in their lives. And the thing is, it's designed not to lead us to being more adjusted to society, though a lot of the practices in it are helpful in that way, but to lead us to freedom from suffering, which means that it gets kind of take no prisoners about what's true and what's not true. But it's also true that, like all these texts, you can interpret it according to your level of consciousness and your own agendas. So traditionally, the Yoga Sutras are interpreted dualistically by people who belong to dualistic traditions. In other words, where you feel that your personal self is separate from the divine. And non-dualistically by those whose tradition is non-dualistic. It can be used by Buddhists, by Catholics, by classical Hatha yogis and non-dual tantricas. And the reason for this is that it's a text that describes human consciousness in all its phases, all its states and stages, And so even as societies change and as modern science overturns the mythic idea of God in the heavens and, you know, the idea of social hierarchies that with a, you know, a ruler, an absolute ruler on top and a bunch of rogue and peasant slaves beneath, we've learned, thank God, to see through that particular fiction. Nonetheless, what these teachings tell us basically remains true. So the science of consciousness, as it's described in the Yoga Sutras, and very much, you know, the Yoga Sutras is very much a process text. It's very much a text that's meant to illuminate our practice. And the thing is, it's verifiable. If you pay attention to these maps and you follow the instructions, of course, adjusting them to time and space and your own understanding and your own state at a given moment. But if you do it the way you would do a lab experiment, you'll get the results that the sages got, despite the fact that we live in such a different time and our conditions are so different. But there's a couple of things that I want to share with you, or that I do share with you, because it's kind of the basis of, you know, what I consider important in spiritual practice. First of all, you really do need to do it. A, you need to do it over time, abhyasa, practiced without interruption for a long time. It's absolutely true. And you also need to develop a sense of how to use your own agency as a practitioner. And this is not something that the text says explicitly. It's, so to speak, not in the textbook, but it's something that we all learn for ourselves in the process. In other words, there's a need to adapt and adjust a practice so that without making anything up, so to speak, without taking yourself outside the realm of what the sages understand to be really workable and helpful, you find a way to make a practice work for you. And this recognition that two things, that you are really the agent of your own transformation along with the extraordinary help of grace, but also the realization that the full panoply of divine light lives inside you. It completely irradiates your subtle body, your causal body, and blazes in your supercausal body. You are that. You are already that. And therefore, the wisdom that can guide you in the places where the text doesn't quite give you the full picture is available to you. Depending on where you're at when you ask the question, you're going to get an answer which will show you the breadcrumb trail that leads you through the self. So, you know, we move back and forth. I find, this is my experience over the years, between being very careful and rigorous about how we follow the practice and how we interpret the teaching, and also the creativity that starts to arise from inside when we really take practice seriously. So the last 10 sutras of Book 1 elaborate on the process of absorption and the different levels of samadhi. And the word that is used in these sutras for the process of getting absorbed in meditation has the same root as the word samadhi. It's samapatti. Samapatti means complete absorption to blending in one. So it is the process in which the mind becomes completely absorbed in an object. And it's kind of the stepping stone to samadhi. Samadhi is a state that arises in the process of coming closer and closer to absorption. And there is a precise correlation. I'm quoting Pandit Rajmani right this minute. There's a precise correlation between the degree of mental absorption, samapatti, and the category of samadhi induced by it. So mental absorption always precedes the experience of samadhi. Samapatti is a process, and samadhi is the state of experience arising from it. Samapatti actually has to do with the melting of our of the natural separative part of our consciousness, of our mind. You know, the subject, which is you, the object, which at this moment, as you're listening to me, I am the object, my voice is the object, and the process, the relationship between subject and object, or in the case of meditation, the process of meditation or the process of knowing. These three categories, subject, object, and process of knowing, or knower, known, and process of knowing, exist in our every phase of our experience. And when subject, object, and process are separated, then we experience separation. So if you remember, Patanjali gives us a list of four objects of meditation. And as I've contemplated this teaching, I realize that it's a pretty exhaustive list. Pretty much anything that you use as a resting place in meditation falls into one of these categories. So we've discussed them before. A physical object, like a flame or a yantra, or a location in the physical body, like the soft palate or the tip of the tongue or the opening of the nostrils or the space behind the breastbone. Physical object, a subtle object, like the mantra, like the inner breath, the prana, the felt sense inside the breath, or an inner light or form or sound. The third type of object is a feeling of joy, the feeling of the subtle feeling, the subtle essential feeling of joy and satisfaction. And the fourth object is your own I sense, your asmita, your ego itself, what my guru used to say, meditate on yourself. And what I came to realize is that what he was talking about is meditate on that place in you where you feel most like yourself. That is, you know, the self that you feel when you're alone and you're, you know, there's not too much going on in your mind and you just kind of nestle. It's often we do this before we go to sleep. Just kind of feel into this relaxed sense of being. And this is the I sense. And it's a profound object of meditation. So these four objects, categories of objects to focus on, are also reflected in the process that happens as we go deeper into meditation. Because successful meditation, or any kind of meditation, starts with focus on an object. And generally speaking, most of us, unless we're super advanced, actually need to make the object a distinct entity in our mind so that focusing can gather up the scattered rays of attention and turn it inward towards one point. This is meditation 101, right? So, you know, whether it's the breath, touching the soft palate, or the heart center, or a mantra, or a visible symbol, you are bringing that object into full focus in your mind. But at that stage, your attention is split. You're aware of yourself as the meditator, the one who's experiencing meditation or trying to experience meditation. You're aware of, let's say, the mantra. We're going to use the mantra as our example here because it's something that all of us, pretty much all of us in this class, do practice with. And you're monitoring your own process of focus, the quality of your focus, the ways your focus gets broken, the attempt to make your focus stronger. You know, you're in the process. Thoughts are coming up. You're dropping the thought. You're getting distracted. You're coming back to the object. So you're in a completely dualistic relationship to the meditation object. And even when it's an inner object, even when it's your own self, your own I sense, there's some part of you that's still keeping it separate from yourself. It's kind of an amazing thing about the human mind. It tends, left to its own devices, to make separation. So then as your meditation deepens, you begin to become more and more, well, absorbed is, of course, the best word. If it's the breath, you might just feel yourself identifying with the rising and subsiding of the breath. It's not so much something you're doing, something you're aware of, but it doesn't seem so different or distant from you. It's like you're assimilating it. And if it's a mantra, the sense of yourself as a body, as a mind, as a meditator, will begin at a certain point to recede, and the mantra itself becomes more and more present. And if you do a lot of mantra practice, there will be a point where the mantra takes over your mind. And, you know, at some point, as you become absorbed in it, this is where it gets really subtle. There's no longer a sense, a distinct sense of the mantra as a word. You know, it's no longer Om with distinct sound and distinct letters. It begins to resolve itself back into the mind, and you begin to experience it as pulsation. So there's a sense of being carried or of sinking into the field of the mind where the mantra resides and arises and subsides from within the mind. And, you know, one of the best pointing out instructions that I ever received from my teacher, and which I try to pass on to you guys, is to actually realize that the real essence of the mantra is not the words or even the meaning, but that vibrating, pulsing energy that arises when the mantra is held in the mind. And at this stage in meditation, as your mind becomes more and more inside of the mantra syllables may dissolve completely, and you may become conscious of what lies behind it, that is, of the mind itself, of the field of the mind itself. And that's where you want to get. Not to deny the beauty of the process, but that moment when mantra dissolves into the mind is a moment of absorption. So in Sutra Book 1, Sutra 43, Patanjali describes this as a state of nirvitarka samapatti, a stage in which the distinctness of the object, actually it's nirvichara because when we talk about mantra, because it's a subtle object, the letters and the sound of the mantra, for instance, begin to fade, and the energetic feeling sense of it becomes primary. So in Tantra, in texts like the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, there are some advanced meditation practices, and they are actually advanced, though we often do them as at early stages in our process. There are these meditation practices that intend to jumpstart the process by allowing us to leapfrog past the objective sense of a word or the breath as an object. And one of my favorites, which, you know, many of you have done with me before, is the practice of meditating on the space within which the mantra arises and subsides. In other words, meditating on the space in the mind where the mantra arises and subsides. So we're going to do this with a slightly longer mantra. We're going to do it with Om Namah Shivaya, which I think is familiar enough to most of you, even if that's not your primary mantra, because we chant it at the beginning of every class. So close your eyes and firm your posture. I like to do this practice with awareness in the heart, and we're going to use the heart kind of as our resting place in this section of the class. You're welcome, if your attention wants to go somewhere else, to allow it to do that. But the point is, it's very helpful to have a kind of an anchor in the body that can kind of help you root yourself within your body, even as you're going into subtler spaces. So with the breath arising and subsiding, begin to think to yourself, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. And as I have sometimes said, when you're repeating a mantra in meditation, it's helpful to kind of slur the syllables, because as you slur the syllables, it lets you kind of start to dissolve the sense of the mantra being a separate object. So just let yourself be present with Om Namah Shivaya. And now become aware of the space at the end of Ya, where the mantra dissolves. So you're thinking Om Namah Shivaya, perhaps coordinating it with the breath. And at the end of the last syllable, you notice how the mantra dissolves. What is left? There's a space there, a space in the mind, and thoughts will probably spring up soon. But in the meantime, as you think the mantra, begin to focus not on the syllables themselves, but on that place within your consciousness, within your mind field, within your inner zone of experience, where the mantra dissolves. And then notice that the mantra arises again, arising from the zone of experience, that is, the energy field of your own mind. You're meditating on the space into which the mantra dissolves and into which it arises. I would be very interested in hearing, because we can do this practice a few times, perhaps on the listserv, what this is like for you. One of the possible gifts that this practice can give you is when you actually find the space at the end of the mantra, which is the space of the deep mind, the mind field itself, you can begin to sense this subtle underlying pleasure and lightness that arises as the mantra, the particles of the mantra mingle with the particles of your consciousness. And it's the same thing that happens when you're meditating with the breath and you tune into the space at the end of the exhalation, and you start to realize that it is a space that is content-free, that is still, and that pulsates with energy. So at some point, you find yourself meditating on the mind itself, the actual field of the mind itself. We'll talk about it later on in Sutra 44. And in the commentary, he explains the subtle objects that lead us to absorption. So for now, you may be conscious of yourself practicing a meditation technique, but as you keep deepening your focus on it, on the space, over time it begins to lengthen and expand, and it becomes easier and easier to stay in that gap. So, and here, if you can allow thoughts to come and go without grabbing them, you actually begin to feel the subtle pulsation of the essence of mantra. And it's this moment when a practice that, you know, involves a word or the movement of breath, which is relatively gross, begins to dissolve into its own energy field, its own essence field. And this is the first stage of the process of what Patanjali calls Savichara and Nirvichara Samapati, the growing feeling of merging in the object, which he defines in Sutra 44. Again, in a long session of meditation, this occurs naturally as the, quote, surface experience of breath or mantra or the sensations in the heart dissolves into the feeling space within the mantra, the felt sense of presence in the heart. You know, in Tantra, it's often said that the letters of the mantra are like the jacket, you know, the shell, and that the true mantra is the Shakti, the energy within the shell. And in the same way, the breath that you inhale and exhale is the gross form of the prana, which is the subtle life force that is the essence of breath, in which we start to experience when we focus on the breath process and allow the breath to take us into the inner breath. So, and in the same way, the presence within the heart is actually the seat of pure awareness within the body. So I'm going to continue to explain these processes, these levels through the mantra. You know, as the mind becomes more absorbed in the mantra begins to pulsate on its own. And at this point, as some of you are describing, several people talked about this in the Q&A and on the listserv this week, that, you know, the mantra starts to repeat itself and it starts to follow you around. You're not trying to repeat it. It's just repeating itself. And after a while, if you keep focusing softly on the feeling that arises as when you focus or notice the mantra's presence in your mind, you become more and more aware of the qualities of that feeling, and you notice that it is that as you focus on that feeling, it's drawing your mind into it. It's changing your inner state, essentially. At the higher stage of samapati and then of samadhi, which happens gradually and results in, you know, in the increasing experience of wavelessness in the mind. You know, you may still be experiencing the basic energetic pulsating quality of the mind, but there's not a thought that really grabs you. And at this stage, the mind begins to become transparent to itself, to the consciousness that is the underpinning of the mind. And this means you're getting closer to what's called nirbija samadhi, the samadhi without seed, not a blank state. It's a state of illumination and joy in which, as we'll keep returning again and again, the seeds of your previous karma start to dissolve. So I know this is subtle technical material, but it really does help us understand the nature of the inner transformation that meditation creates. And I've found that in order for this, for the full transformation to occur, there are three conditions that are really helpful. First, you know, meditation 101, you need to keep refocusing whenever the mind wanders. And more than that, closing the gap between yourself and the object of meditation. And this is where you can actually get quite creative. This is where you want to make creative adjustments in the way you practice, as I know many of you do. So in other words, you don't want to settle for the feeling of, okay, I am meditating and I'm meditating on this mantra. You want to create a sense of identity with the object. And you do this not all at once, but with bhavas, with attitudes. So, for instance, one way to do this is to cultivate the idea that, you know, since the mantra is appearing within your own consciousness, it is therefore not separate from you. It's an aspect of yourself. Om Namah Shivaya, Hamsa, Om. It's sounding inside your own field of awareness. In other words, it is actually not something separate. It's a sound that, at this moment at least, is part of you. Another way to close the gap between me and the object, and this is one that I work with a lot, is to keep focusing on the felt sense of energy within the mantra or within the breath, and feeling that energy as a kind of inner sensation, and allowing the inner sensation to swell past that little nugget, which is the mantra, until it begins to mingle with the felt sense of your interior. So let's say that you're meditating with Om Namah Shivaya, or if you prefer with Hamsa, the mantra that we're working with in this class. And you notice that it has a kind of energetic feel to it. Now see if you can, as it were, draw your mind into that energetic field. Allow that feeling of energy associated with the mantra to grow. Feel as though it can grow so that it takes up your whole inner space. And to help you do this, you might also use your inner senses. What do you see in the space where the mantra is? What do you hear, if anything? What's the felt sense of it, the sense of touch in it? As you work creatively to kind of enlarge the presence of the mantra in your mind, as you engage yourself more deeply in it, you might begin to feel that the energy within the mantra is assimilating itself more and more into the energy of your own mind field. So this is the first condition, is being willing to actually interact creatively in order to bring yourself more and more to feel the presence of the object becoming one with your own mind. The second condition, which is very important and helpful, is to have some confidence, some faith that this is going to work. Sounds like a no-brainer, but it actually really makes a difference. And the third condition is being willing to give the process time to mature. You know, we're meditating for short periods in this class, but when you sit by yourself, you can meditate for long enough to actually begin to feel the mind opening up to receive fully the energy inside the mantra. And, you know, what will happen is that the process deepens on its own. You know, when we start on chapter 2 in the next series, and, you know, we of course come across the 8 limbs, and we come across the last 3 limbs in the 8 limbs. The internal process starts with dharana, which is usually translated as concentration or focus. And as we sit with the dharana, which would be in this case the mantra, there's a spontaneous morphing in which our attention is seized by the shakti within the mantra and the shakti within the mind, and it starts to be pulled inwards. And this process of being pulled inwards is called dhyana. It's usually translated as meditation. But what it actually means is that the mind is literally becoming spontaneously filled with the object, with the mantra. And this process of moving from dharana into dhyana does not happen by will, although being one-pointedly focused is a big help. It's actually a natural process. It happens on its own, and through the grace of the Shakti. It's helpful to do, you know, to accompany it with a devotional practice like Ishvara Pranidhan, because what really deepens your meditation is grace. One reason why Patanjali says again and again that Ishvara Pranidhan, graceful surrender to God, is so important in reaching samadhi. And by God, of course, we don't necessarily mean a personal deity. We could mean reality itself. So as this happens, as the mind becomes pulled inside, as being seized by the inner current of Shakti, you begin to be able to see or be at least be aware of the thoughts arising and subsiding, like chatter going on in the background, but they lose their charge, so you don't get grabbed by the thoughts. And this is really important. We're going to come back to it again and again. When you start to be able to feel the mind moving inward, allowing the thoughts to be there as background noise without trying to grab them or push them away, this is the process that begins to actually purify the vrittis and eventually the samskaras. You know, the transformation that we experience through meditation, through savichara and nirvichara levels of absorption, through samapatti, the quality of insight that is the essence of wisdom begins to take over. And we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, but you begin to be able to see the thoughts as foam on the waters of your consciousness. And the faculty of discerning wisdom, Sanskrit word is prajna, begins to show you the real relationship between your thoughts and the field of the mind. In other words, it begins to show you that the thoughts just come and go. You don't have any control over them, and you don't have to pay any attention to them. You can just let them come and go. And you begin to see what the mind is. You just begin to get more and more insight about the nature of your inner field, to watch the movements of ego happening. And, you know, this is the state in which you can even get an intuition of how the chitta, the field of the mind, the energy of the mind, is a natural extension of the field of pure consciousness. And this happens through the emergence of your prajna, the subtle intuitive wisdom. So we've spoken before, I think it was last week, about the appearance of prajna, of subtle interior intuitive wisdom. I feel that that one of the great gifts that we get from regular meditation is that we begin to be able to distinguish prajna, true intuitive wisdom, from intellectual understanding, which of course is very present for some of you more than others. But, you know, one of the things that certainly is my experience in meditation is that all kinds of insights arise, and some of them are very much mind-born or intellectually born insights, but some of them really come from a place of truth. The thing about prajna, this intuitive wisdom, is that it's a completely non-linear experience. You know, prajna can see everything at once. It can see the whole field of whatever inquiry is arising and understand reality, get reality, you know, grok reality, in a way that we just can't figure out through the mind because the mind is just too linear. So I know that many of you have experienced and, you know, experience regularly downloads of wisdom and intuition, you know, in which, for instance, you see the true nature of your karmic situation, or you get a sense of how the universe works, or you see past your superficial understanding of a relationship, or, you know, you get an intuition of, that can be the basis of, you know, a scientific breakthrough or a creative breakthrough. It's, you know, it's very difficult to describe this experience because, as I say, it's not linear. It's not mind-born. The word that's often used for it is realization. In other words, a piece of truth becomes fully real to you. It's not a matter of speculation. It's knowing as true experience, carrying total conviction, no doubt at all. So let's just follow the breath into the heart for a moment. Dropping, sorry to keep switching mantras on you, but dropping hum into the heart space, letting it swell inside the heart. And then with the exhalation, as you allow the second syllable, sa, to float inside the heart space, which is also the space of your mind, the lotus of the heart and the inner mind, turn out to be not different. The lotus of the heart is an entrance point into the true nature of mind, consciousness itself. Allowing the breath to arise and subside with hum and sa. I'm hoping that you can keep some part of your attention here in this inner space and listen to me with awareness there as it were, listening from the heart. Because this is the situation, this is a practice which allows your prajna to meet the words I'm speaking and actually give you a sense of how they can be used by your consciousness in its journey of expansion. So this experience of the just sudden emergence of prajna, of this intuition, is often the experience of people who become teachers or mission-driven activists. They are often people who've had a kind of awakening where some truth that they might not even have been aware of before, or that they might have been trying to understand, suddenly comes as a download. My first teacher began teaching as a result of one of these experiences. He was sitting in meditation one day, and he'd been a seeker. He'd done a lot of practice. He was sitting in meditation one day, and he got this realization that he was supposed to start a spiritual school, and that the nature of the spiritual school would be to use what he had learned from Western Sufi teachers, in his case, to open up the mystical tradition, the Western mystical tradition, in a way that had not been done before, that had not been accessible before. And his first reaction was, "Oh no, that's not the right thing for me to do. I'm not a people person. I don't like being around a lot of people." And that was true about him. But he did it. He followed it, and created this school, and which has had a profound effect on the people who have been with him over the years. And you may know other teachers who experienced a sense of, "I am supposed to be doing this," you know, as a kind of an arising of prajna. And not just spiritual teachers, you know, it's the realization that makes you, you know, understand that you're supposed to go to South Sudan and really give yourself to, you know, work there, that you're supposed to, you know, that you're supposed to write a novel, that you've been sort of trying to understand what your writing jam may be or your music jam, and you suddenly get it. This is my next album, and I'm supposed to have a child. I mean, you get these things. The thing is, if the awakening happens without being accompanied by practice, and here I'm going back to, to the field of mission, of, you know, life work. If it's not accompanied by practice, meaning if the citta is not being continually purified by meditation and inquiry into your own motives and into your own wisdom, it's very easy for the mind to hijack a realization and create entire structures that are basically mental, not powered by the original prajna. I've been researching conspiracy theories in a sort of a dilettantish way over the last few weeks, because there are just so many of them around. And in the course of it, I came across a documentary that was made by someone who is one of the leading conspiracy theorists around today. And he described an experience of an awakening that he had, in which a presence surrounded him, and he got this complete download of the way things actually are. You know, he saw through the game, and what he saw was not so different from what the sages see. You know, that this realization that it's our conditioning, our beliefs, the experience that's coming through the senses that is creating our experience of the world. And it was obviously a very profound experience and utterly life-changing for him. But what he then did was he interpreted this as an indication that what he was supposed to do with his life is find out who it is that is actually behind the fakery of, you know, the matrix. And he came up with this theory, which is not an unusual theory. It's similar to, you know, the Illuminati conspiracy and many other conspiracies, that there was a group of people, rich people, who were trying to take over the world. And he's, you know, traveled around the world ever since telling people about these conspiracies. He's one of the main advocates of the Bill Gates conspiracy theory. And I'm an agnostic about all this, but it seems to me that once you start bringing your own mind into your realizations and coming up with ideas and theories about what's so, you are on very shaky ground, and it's extremely necessary to keep returning to the field of prajna and checking your mind-borne insights against that truth that you originally experienced. And this is true, of course, of people whose awakenings are genuine spiritual awakenings. Very often, or at least a fair amount of the time, you know, we have enlightenment experiences that are absolutely real and genuine. But generally speaking, they don't last. Maybe they last for a few days or weeks or months, or in some cases even years. But when you decide that as a result of this awakening, it means that your sadhana is over, your practice is over, and it's now time to begin enlightening others, again, you're stepping into a terrain that may end up deluding you and other people. So why these downloads, why these experiences, these enlightenment experiences are not enough to free you, really has to do with the nature of karma and samskaras. And that the fact is that whenever you have a normal deep meditation, you know, you have a really good day, as it were, in meditation, you come out feeling different than you did when you went in, what that means is that there has been some samskaric burn-off in the process of meditation. And sometimes the samskaric burn-off is rather uncomfortable. But you can always tell if you come out feeling different, if you come out feeling lighter, even, you know, even if just for a few minutes, it means that you've lost some of your karmic baggage. But the thing is, we have a lot of it. You know, we have a ton of samskaric baggage, which get attenuated in the process of meditation, but we need to come back again and again and again to keep literally dipping the mind into, dipping the thinking part of the mind into the field of prajna and letting it gradually cook, burn off our samskaras and karmic baggage. So prajna, as we said earlier, it's called a unique kind of knowledge. It's not mind-borne. And what it leads us to, or what it can lead us to, is an intuitive experience of our own consciousness, our own deeper mind field, as the resting place of meditation. You know, we sometimes describe this experience as awareness of awareness. You know, and we do a practice, I teach it, many other teachers teach it, where you focus attention on the body, on the breath, you know, step by step, and then bring attention on thoughts, and then bring attention to that which knows your feeling body sensations, to that which knows your thinking, and, you know, to, in other words, the awareness, the consciousness. And with practice, awareness of awareness can become a kind of habit, that is, a samskara of its own, a meditative samskara, which you can use as a doorway into samadhi. And some of the most advanced practices of tantric meditation, such as the Dzogchen or Mahamudra practices in Buddhism, or the direct path process of immersing yourself in awareness, allows us to really look directly into our own mind and to start to see thoughts arising and to realize that they just arise. This is when we begin meditating on the most, this is what Sutra 45 says, meditation on the most subtle object is that which dissolves into the field of prakriti, which he calls the irreferable prakriti, meaning that prakriti has no frame of reference, it just is. Prakriti in the philosophical systems that we're working with here, prakriti is the matrix, the true matrix, within which everything that we know as life and the world exists. And when you become aware of your own mind as a field of energy and let yourself just be really present with it over a period of time, allowing the thoughts to dissolve, allowing the agitation of the mental instruments to quiet down, allowing the manas, the part of the mind which is constantly roaming around collecting sense data, you know, allowing the manas to slow down and turn inside and begin to notice inner phenomena, you know, like the way your heart space feels, you know, and then after a while, the ahamkara, the mechanism that is identifying with your activity as a meditator, you know, or getting lost in memories, the ahamkara relaxes. And at this point, your primary experience in deep meditation is inward. The flow of attention is within the subtle field of the mind. And if you can rest there for a while without grasping for outcomes or picking up a thought, you find yourself poised in the subtlest part of your mind field, which is the buddhi, the discriminating pure intelligence, the aware knower. And you know, normally when we're in a thought-free or quiet meditation, what is happening is that the manas and the ahamkara have retired, so to speak, and what's left is the pure intelligence itself, the buddhi, which is the aspect of your mind which is able to reflect both what appears on the outside, but also the state of pure consciousness. So the buddhi has a mirror-like quality. When it's turned outward, it reflects the input from the sense mind and the egoic mind and identifies yourself as those. When it turns inward, the buddhi gets decoupled from the sense data and thoughts and the tendency to identify thoughts and emotions as me, and gradually its mirror-like quality begins to turn backwards and reflect awareness itself. And gradually over time, you actually find yourself turning into Prakriti. And I want to work with a particular practice, which was a big breakthrough practice for me about 20 years ago, when I first started realizing that I needed to create more agency in my meditation practice if I wanted to go deeper. And I'm going to explain it to you as well and give you instructions at the same time. So close your eyes and sit up. Sit up nice and tall for this moment. And again, bring your awareness into the heart. And just let the breath arise and subside. The inhalation flowing into the heart. And with your attention basically focused in the heart, what I'd like you to do is look at the field that appears in front of you with your closed eyes. So you're not looking into the heart, you're just looking, so to speak. Your eyes are closed, so it's your inner sight that's looking. You're looking at the field of your own consciousness. And it probably looks like a succession of little scintillating dots, waves. It's a very alive thing, the field of the mind. It maybe has colors. It's extremely dynamic. Now, again, you're focusing, you know, a piece of your attention is in the heart. That's your seat. But what you're going to do is imagine yourself cutting a hole or a window inside this field that you see with your eyes closed and moving your attention through the hole, through the opening, you're actually moving out of the sense of being in the body and moving into the consciousness field. And I'm going to ask you to do it by moving in front. You could do it moving behind if that is natural, but for now we're going to imagine ourselves traveling in front of the body through this field of consciousness. And here's a trick, if you can do it. As you are propelled through this field, imagine that you become the space of awareness that appears in front of you. In other words, this is a little bit like those old Pac-Man, that old Pac-Man game that some of you may have played when you were younger, or I don't think it's available now, in which your mind is eating, ingesting whatever is appearing in front of you, and this allows you to propel your consciousness, to propel your attention deeper and deeper into the field. If you have begun with awareness in the heart, there might be a sense of energy around the heart. And if this is the case, see if you can actually create an opening in that sense of energy and let yourself fully move with your entire inner energy, your entire attention, deeper and deeper into the space that appears in front of you. And as you journey forward, notice that this field is actually kind of boundless. See if you can find the edges of it. And as you look for the edges of it, what you'll probably notice is that there actually is not an edge. The field of consciousness that you enter here, that you move through, is potentially infinite. And just let yourself be present moving in that field until you reach a point where you're okay to just relax and be present. And let yourself take rest in it. What you have entered in this practice is the field of Prakriti. The field of Prakriti, which can expand infinitely and which has these qualities of energy, intelligence, and endless creativity. Prakriti, this field is perhaps streaked with light, forms may be appearing in it. And if you can keep yourself from going down the rabbit hole of a thought and just keep opening, relaxing, sensing the spaciousness of the consciousness that is just behind the thought stream, the expanded mind flowing into the great mind of Prakriti. And I want to say, if it feels too big, if you feel you might get lost, I just want to remind you of what my guru always used to say, don't worry, if you get lost, I'll find you. And this is really true. So with your next inhalation, feel that you gather your attention, bring it back into the heart. And again, just sense the breath. And with the breath, with the feeling of the breath flowing in and flowing out. See if you can let yourself simply relax, be present in this moment, in the now. And see if you can be aware of the awareness. That knows what you're experiencing. That holds you. Your experience. And which is, as you get to know it more and more deeply, which is the field of brilliance and truth, known as prajna. Now, one of the gifts of meditation, one of the gifts that we experience when we get really poised in this inner expanded state, it becomes something that we carry with us into the waking state. And as an open-eyed state, the experience of connection with prajna is a state that's very familiar to athletes and actors who can get so absorbed in their task or their role that they slip into what Billie Jean King called the zone, or what is also called the state of flow. You know, and in that state, you're actually being guided by prajna. You're being guided by that subtle intelligence which is so far past the mind that it knows exactly where the ball is going to go, what is exactly the right thing to say. It lets you move through the seams of reality without fear or second-guessing yourself. And this is the state in which, you know, you suddenly find yourself running into exactly the person that you wanted to see, despite the fact that, as far as you know, they're in another town altogether. That state where, you know, you start to experience events that feel really almost like miracles, because your life begins to be arranged by prajna. So yoga, in essence, is what we do to give ourselves regular access to the state of prajna, which in its higher reaches reveals itself as what the yoga text called avirtambara prajna, which is usually translated as truth-bearing intuition. Intuition that is always true. I have the word rita in Ritambara it's a very significant word. It appears in the Vedic text. It's a very old concept. It has the same root as right and the same root as rhythm, and it means something like universal law or cosmic rightness. So rita is a deep righteousness, goodness. Prefigures the concept of dharma, but carries some of the same meaning. So when the sages call prajna the state that is natural to your own mind, to your own awareness, just covered by the veils of thoughts and the kleshas, they're talking about a wisdom that is naturally in harmony with cosmic law. And, you know, so one of the differences between prajna and ordinary intellectually based intelligence is that prajna is always fully in accord with the good, with the highest level of righteousness. So, you know, our human creativity, especially in this age of technology, often, you know, our creativity, our capacity for invention, often outpaces what we understand to be good for other humans and animals and the planet. Prajna never does. Prajna knows when, you know, that technological innovation that is so amazing and that you have creatively discovered, Prajna knows when it's better not to put it to use, because it will have destructive powers that you don't want to mess with. Prajna knows what the right thing to do is. And, you know, so the mantras that we sing, that, you know, that we've been listening to at the beginning of all the classes, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, lead me from the unreal to the real, lead us from darkness, from tamas to jyoti, to light, lead us from mrityu, from death, to amrita, to the nectar of immortality. We are actually addressing our own prajna, the inner guide, the guiding wisdom within us. So in Sutra 150, right at the end of Book 1, it says, samskaras born of intuitive wisdom, samskaras that come from prajna, cancel all other samskaras. So this is how, in the long run, freedom happens, through meditation, through repeatedly entering into a state of absorption into the subtle field of buddhi, allowing buddhi to begin to reflect pure consciousness, allowing ourselves to actually meditate on the field of prakriti, which is filled with every kind of wisdom. The samskaras of meditation gradually drive out the limiting samskaras that keep us trapped in the kleshas. So, you know, the great metaphor for this is what happens when you pour clean water into a dirty glass, into the muddy water in a glass. Just keep pouring the water, and the muddy water runs out, and then the glass is filled with clean water. And this is actually what happens through meditation. The limiting samskaras, the ones that keep us trapped in the kleshas, just begin to be driven out by the samskaras of meditation and realization and truth, the intuitions of Ritambara Prajna, or Pratibha, which is another name for Prajna, both of them meaning intuitive wisdom. We don't really understand how this happens. It's a mysterious process. You know, we don't understand how self-realization happens. But as we keep diving into meditation again and again, as we keep following the prompts that we gradually begin to recognize that come from that intuitive state, little by little, realization dawns and we become the self that we already are. And the real gift of long-time practice is that over time, the experience of our pure being, our pure I-ness, begins to become predominant, so that even when pain arises, even when there's anger or grief or confusion arising, which it seems to do in the life of every being, including very advanced yogis, but the difference between a beginning yogi and a normal person, an unpracticed person, and a sage, is that, you know, as our practice advances, the backlog of truth-bearing samskaras begins to transform your outlook, so that there's always wisdom that's arising from within you telling you, okay, I'm freaked out about this. This is how I should approach it. You know, I'm furiously angry. How can I work with this situation without suppressing the anger and without acting it out? Prajna, your prajna knows, and it begins to take over. And this is what we mean when we talk about enlightenment. It is actually the takeover of our klesha-filled, samskara-filled, vasana-filled mind by the truth-bearing wisdom that arises from the self. So, and this is, I would say, this is the money teaching right here, because, you know, we're talking about yoga as the way out of suffering, the path out of suffering. So what these states begin to do is they burn the seeds, they roast the seeds of samskaras. And, you know, as we move through the stages of sabija, meditative absorption and start to have moments of nirbija meditative absorption, states where there really is, where the mind really is not moving at all. And they may be very short at the beginning, but in every one of those moments, more and more of the seeds of our karmas are burned. So when the enlightened samskaras, the residue of meditation and spiritual joy and teachings are present, are as they are for many of you, much of the time, our minds feel free and clear. But interlarded with these are the kleshas and the feelings generated by the kleshas. So they'll keep showing up and surprising us, especially when they're being dredged up by strong practice. This is happening for many of you during this class. But at some point, we become able to spend periods of time in meditation and eventually out of meditation where we're in a truly thought-free state. And we're in nirbija. And this is the place, where, and this is a very advanced state, but it's a real state, where the only thing in your way, in the way of your full freedom, is the samskaras of your spiritual practice. Believe it or not, at this stage of meditation, our spiritual samskaras become an obstacle, the samskaras of our meditation. You know, I mean, we get this experience often when, you know, you're meditating, you're saying the mantra, you're practicing a technique, and it disappears, and you're just left for a moment in quiet, and the mind comes back and says, is this okay? Why did I lose the mantra? And, you know, we don't have the understanding sometimes to realize that, oh, okay, this is a waveless state that has emerged, and let me just be present in that. Then if thoughts start to come up, you go back to your technique, you know, or a different one, if that's being suggested. But as Vyasa says in one of the commentaries on these sutras, our practice and the teachings purify the mind and lead us right through the early stages of samadhi. But after that, what allows us to break through is real vairagya, the real ability to give up even the beautiful states that we love so much, that we've come to love so much. And this level of detachment, of sort of ultimate vairagya, it's called para vairagya, supreme detachment. And in my experience, para vairagya is the state where you're willing to let go of your identity as a separate self. Very few of us are willing to do that in the early stages of our practice, and for most of us, it takes a while before we're actually willing to leap into the fire, leap into the ocean of consciousness, and just let what happens happen. Fortunately, the infinite wisdom is extremely patient. So, you know, we get to move through this in stages. But when Patanjali says that surrender to God, Ishvara Pranidhan, leads to samadhi, this is what he's talking about. He's saying that in order to really merge into consciousness to the point where we experience that melting into the ocean of bliss that the great sage Shankaracharya talks about, he says, my mind, like a hailstone, melted into the ocean of bliss. And this is really the fruit of the practice that the Yoga Sutra is pointing us towards. So as we become more and more cooked in our process, as our ahamkara, the grabby egoic mind, begins to release its hold on us, begins to melt, and as the supramental wisdom, of prajna arises more and more, the prajna itself lets us slip past the guard dogs of the ego-driven mind and right into the pure field of consciousness. once for a minute, another time for 5 minutes, and over time, more and more. And as this happens more and more, as we begin to allow ourselves to let go of whatever it is that feels like it's in between us and pure awareness, we start to learn how to let go of effort and allow ourselves to be quiet. You know, there's a wonderful analogy that Ramakrishna gives. He talks about the two kinds of spiritual students. They're the monkey students and the kitten students. And you know, he says that a baby monkey clings to his mother's back because his mother won't pick him up. So if he wants to stay with his mother, he has to hang on. Whereas the kitten doesn't hang on at all. You know, it's a bit of anatomical difference between monkeys and kittens, but be that as it may, this is about bhava attitude. So the kitten just lies there and mews for its mother, and the mother comes and picks it up by the scruff of the neck and takes it where the baby kitten wants to go. And I think the thing about the kitten is that she is able to just wait until mom comes and picks her up. So in our early stages of practice, we need to hang on. You know, we need to hold on to our practice and to hang on to identifying ourselves with ourselves as spiritual seekers, because it's the antidote to all the mundane identifications that we hold. As our practice matures, we can let go of that. We can let go of our impatience. We can let go of trying to make something happen, which is very, very useful in some of the earlier stages of meditation. And we can just wait to be carried. And in the Sufi tradition, which is very much a tradition based on this moment, when we realize that there's, you know, when the aspirant realizes there's nothing more he can do, and he just lies down in the middle of the road and says, "Oh God, I'm lost. If I'm going to experience you, you're going to have to do it for me." And it's a moment in Sufi poetry. If you've read Sufi poetry, you know that it's a big, poignant moment. There's often a lot of despair in it. There are tears. There's heartbreak. And ultimately, there's just a kind of, okay, whatever. And at that moment in the poems, and in my experience in real life, there's a shift. The spirit of Ishvara, the spirit of reality, comes and picks you up and shows you the thing you've longed for, the state you've longed for. So the more we turn into the inner world, the more we catch glimpses of its beauty, the more that longing becomes a primary motivator. And all the different subsidiary longings and desires that we have, good as they are, and many of them are really good, really helpful, nonetheless, they begin to take more and more of a back seat to this desire to know the self, this desire to fully open the heart and to live in that way, to live by the light of Ritambara Prajna all the time. So, my dear ones, we are at the end of our time together, and we're going to end just sitting in meditation with the mantras, which Deb will put on in a moment, and you know, which we'll just sit with for a round or two before we close. And I want to again invite you to come back together. Our next class starts on June 17th, which I'm pretty sure is a Wednesday. For those of you who have something you always have to do on Tuesday night, we're switching to Wednesday. So that those of you who maybe have something to do on Wednesday can switch places, as it were. And I just want to say this second level of the class will be very much focused on how we get from where we are to where we want to be. It's the chapter called Sadhanapada, which deals with karma, with the nitty-gritty of samskaras, with the whole process of meditation, with Kriya Yoga, which is my favorite sutra in the Yoga Sutra, which says to attenuate the kleshas and take you into samadhi, practice tapas, swadhyaya, and ishvara pranidhan. Practice intense effort. Practice self-inquiry and investigation of the texts that deal with truth. Mental repetition, cultivating the self, that's swadhyaya, self-study, and ishvara pranidhan, bringing yourself more and more into alignment with grace, with what in the devotional traditions they call divine will, the icha shakti, that wants to take you to your highest state of truth. So with huge blessing, let's bring our hands into Anjali Mudra. May this practice that we have done together open my heart, bring me fully into the field of pure awareness and love. May it be of benefit to everyone whose life touches mine, and ultimately to all beings. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be free. May everyone I love and everyone I seem to have an aversion to be happy, be healthy, and be free. And may all beings rest in the truth of who we are. Namaste. May the blessings of the sages that live in this text irradiate every moment of your life. Thank you so much.
Tamasu ma chyo
Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor mam Oh,